You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Reading up on Tom McGuane, I learned that he is the only member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters who is also in the National Cutting Horse Association Hall of Fame, which is pretty cool. He also won the Fly Rod and Reel Angler of the Year and the Trout Unlimited Conservation Award. He's been living in South Central Montana since his 20s, where he raises or has raised in the past Black Angus cattle, and where many, as you know, of his extraordinary novels, stories, and essays are set. And in his new story collection, Crow Fair, you'll meet characters engaged in what McGuane calls, quote, the tremendous congestion of life. There are working people like the fencer with knotted, damaged hands, and the cafeteria cook who's suffered, quote, generations of students ridiculing her food. We all know her. There are oddballs and eccentrics like the oaf who leaves his blind grandmother on the riverbank. And there are animals lovingly described like the old dog, quote, sleeping with a canceled postage stamp stuck to his butt. His characters often take wrong turns and make small but disastrous miscalculations, all of which make for a damn good story. Tom McGuane started out his writing career wanting to be a comic novelist. Mark Twain is one of his favorite writers, and I predict that your funny bone will be rattled by reading A Crow Fair. Mine certainly was. I kept shaking my husband awake at night and saying, I have to read this out loud to you. His humor is deep, though often made painful by his character's self-realization, that moment when they explain their own actions to themselves. As McGuane has noted, quote, it's not my job to put a smile on your face. That's the job of your bartender and your pharmacist. And in conversation tonight with Tom McGuane, we have David L. Ulan, and I know many of you depend, as I do, on David's insights into both new books and classics as we read his outstanding work in the LA Times, where he is a book critic. He's the author of The Lost Art of Reading, Why Books Matter in a Distracted Time, and boy, are they distracted, and The Myth of Solid Ground, Earthquakes, Prediction, and the Fault Line Between Reason and Faith. His new book, Sidewalking, Coming to Terms with Los Angeles, will be out from UC Press next fall. We're looking forward to that. Please join me in welcoming Tom McGuane and David Ulan. Thank you.
I paid for all that.
All right, so we're gonna start off with a little reading, and then we will talk for a while, and then we will open it up to questions from you guys. So,
I'll read you a story that I published in the New Yorker a couple years ago, but it's the shortest one in this book. It'll leave us room to talk afterwards. I love to talk to people who like to talk, and this is a story called "The Casserole." Does everyone here know what a casserole is? That's going to be an important turning point in this story. We waited under the cottonwoods for the ferry to come back across the Missouri River, but the heat still throbbed from the metal of our car, and it turned out to be better to stand close to the water. The river seemed so big, its incongruous whisper belying its steady speed. Clouds of swallows chased insects over the water, and doves rested in the shadows. My wife kept touching her forehead with the Kleenex and staring across at the ferry, as if to hurry its return. We could see the ferryman chatting with his passengers, which only increased her agitation. We were heading from our home in Livingston to Ellie's family ranch to celebrate our 25th anniversary. 25 years and no children. Her parents had stopped interrogating us about this. They assumed that it was a physical problem that some clinic could solve, but we didn't want children. We lacked the courage to tell them that. We both liked children, we just didn't want any ourselves. There were children everywhere, and we saw no reason to start our own brand. Young couples plunge into parenthood, and about half the time they end up with some nasty problem on their hands. We thought we'd leave that to others. But my in-laws were elderly, and they had the usual views of hereditary landowners. They longed for an heir. They had acquired their land from my wife's grandfather, and with it, a belief in family values that did not stand up to scrutiny, since most ranches these days were the scene of bitter inheritance battles. But even if my wife had had siblings, she would not have been part of this sort of trouble. She had never, at least not since adolescence, wanted to pursue ranch life, rural life, agricultural life. She would have said to any sibling, "Take it, it's all yours, I'm out of here." There would have been an element of posturing in this because she was very attached to the land. She just didn't want to own it or to do anything with it, and neither did I. The thing was that we were quite poor. We were both grade school teachers, and owning a house had been the extent of our indulgences. We loved our house and our work, and were suitably grateful for both, though Ellie felt that if I hadn't been so hell-bent on retiring the mortgage, we might have done a few more things for fun. My in-laws couldn't believe that we had no interest in owning a ranch that was worth millions, but they wouldn't have allowed us to sell it. We'd be stuck with it, and if we went along with them, which we weren't about to do, and so now they were stuck with it. Cows, farming equipment, fences, the whole enchilada, and they were getting old. The ranch was going to eat them alive, and they knew it. The fences would fall, the cows would get out, the neighbors, old friends, would start to think of them as a problem. Once across this river, we'd be heading for a very sad story.
Let me get some water.
Well, not that sad. They'd had their day, and it was almost over. That's how it is for everybody. They like to be seen as heroic strivers, alone on the unforgiving prairie. But they could have handed the ranch over, no strings attached, and headed for Arizona. After the sale, there would have been plenty for everybody. I had an extensive collection of West Coast jazz records, including the usual suspects, Jerry Mulligan, Chet Baker, Stan Getz, and so on. Not everyone has Wardell Gray and Buddy Collette, but I did. And if I'd had a bit more dough, I could have added a room onto our house specifically to house my collection with an appropriate sound system. But when I complain about things like this to Ellie, she just says, "Cue the violins." It looked as though our appallingly high-mileage compact car was going to be the only one going on the ferry. My wife and I sat in the front while the back seat was filled with her belongings, as was the trunk. I had no idea why she felt called upon to bring this exalted volume of luggage, unless it was to store things on the ranch that were cluttering up our little house. I could have asked, but I didn't feel like it. "I think he's turning around," Ellie said, and I came out of my trance. The cable groaned next to us, and across the river I could see the ferry finally moving our way. Ellie was looking forward to this visit. I certainly was not. The ranch was where she had grown up, a nature lover. Despite all its deficiencies, it was still her place on earth. We watched the ferry tack across the Missouri, tugging at an angle to the cable, then landing with a broad thump on the ramp. The ferryman, who was far too young for the wide ride, for the wide red suspenders he affected, motioned us forward, and I drove our piece-of-shit car onto the dock. While we crossed, my wife stood on the ferry dock, looking. Let's just stop right there. My God. While we crossed, my wife stood on the ferry deck, looking out at the river, smiling and sighing at the swallows circling the current. I told her that they were just after the bugs. She said she understood that, but they looked beautiful, whatever they were doing. Was that all right? I've long had trouble with people picking out some detail of the landscape and pretending it's the whole story, as though, in this case, the blue light around those speeding birds could do anything to mask the desolation of the country north of the river, a land which I traverse holding my nose. "Aren't you going to get out of the car?" she asked. "Who's supposed to drive it off the ferry?" I said. I looked away from my wife and turned on the radio. No signal. I thought about her peculiar cheer today. I suppose it was the prospect of seeing her mother and father, of revisiting the scenes of her childhood, which she had done often enough to prove the utter heroism of my patience. Though in recent times we had talked less and less, which begged the question, what was there to talk about? We worked and we saved. We saved quite a bit more than Ellie would have had she been in charge of things. What was becoming a comfortable nest egg would have disappeared in jaunts to Belize or some other place where Ellie could show more of the body she was so proud of to anyone and everyone. She once had the nerve to point out that all the saving up for old age was remarkable for someone who had so much contempt for the elderly. I said, ha, ha, ha. She was going to have to settle for wiggling her butt in the school corridors until the inevitable day when the damn thing sagged. At last we landed, and I drove off. Ellie was having a lively chat with the ferryman, and she took her time getting back to the car. I stared straight through the windshield until she got around to it. When she climbed in with a sort of bounce, she exclaimed, "He grew up in the neighbor's place, the Showalters. He's a Showalter. He graduated from Wynn and High, where I went." "Ah," I said. The ranch was no more than half an hour from the ferry. Ellie's excitement grew along the route, and here is a sampler of her exclamations. "Look at all the antelope. There must be 100. Oh, I smell the sage. This road looks like a silver ribbon. Those are all red-tailed hawks riding that thermal. Larkspur. What a grass year. Can you imagine what Dad's calves will look like?" To this last, I said, "No." I honestly thought she was getting manic as we approached the ranch. Ellie is an enthusiast, but this went well beyond her usual behavior. I don't know if she detected my concern, but she seemed to catch herself and clam up. She was talking less, but I could still feel her glee from my position at the wheel, and I wondered if this situation called for a pill. I drove under the ranch gate with its iron brand hanging overhead, two inverted V's known in the graceful local vernacular as the squaw tits. Dad, as I had long felt obliged to call him, and his wife, Mom, stood at the edge of the yard, framed from behind by their bitter little clapboard house. Dad was in full regalia, Stetson hat, leather vest, cowboy boots, and this was new, a six-gun. Mom was dressed more conventionally except for the lace-up boots with her wash dress and the lunch pail she was holding. Believe me, it was Methuselah and his bride at the Grand Old Opry. There was something about their expressions I didn't like. It was my turn to keep busy as I tried to elicit signs of life from this tableau, which now included my somber wife. Dad helped me unload Ellie's considerable luggage, and once it was all out on the ground, Mom handed me the lunch pail. "What is this?" I asked. "Something to eat on your way home, a casserole." I turned to Ellie. Tears had filled her eyes. I felt that this could have been handled in another way without Dad's hand on the gun and so forth. I think at times like this, your first concern is to hang on to a shred of dignity. If I had a leg to stand on, it was that Ellie was upset and I was not. What kind of an idiot puts a casserole in a lunch pail? After I got back on the ferry, I thought the thought that I was headed home. Well, I wasn't entirely comfortable with this thought, and I didn't enjoy the ferryman staring at me or asking if someone had shot my dog. I just stared out at the river. There was hardly a ripple on it, and miles to go before the next bend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I thought I'd start by asking you a little bit about that story.
Okay.
Because it does something I think a lot of these stories do. It operates a bit by indirection. We think it's about something, and then it turns out to be about something else. And in many ways, the key dramatic moment almost happens in between moments.
Right.
You know, nothing is actually overtly said. So how did that, I wonder, first we can talk about how the story came about, and then also I'm really curious about that as a kind of storytelling strategy, that sort of understated way of developing the narrative.
Well, I thought I was writing a very different story than this story, and that happens to me a lot. And I think that probably one of the things that happened is I was characterizing this narrator in such a way that I became increasingly annoyed with him. And I wanted to cook his goose, in effect. But the other thing, it was kind of interesting reading this, because sometimes with some people, you read it aloud, they begin to think that I think he's a great guy. and they're kind of looking at me thinking, you know, is this a story? I like the idea of, because I think it's a little bit universal, of these kind of oblivious males that are in situations, sometimes they've been teed up by the culture to think that they don't need to think more about who they live with and what they're doing, because what they do is so important. And this is a very small-scale study in that kind of character. And I think that's sort of the subtext of what I had in mind.
Is it difficult to write write a first-person narrator who you don't necessarily identify with? I mean, obviously, the standard reader's trope is that the writer somehow identifies with that first-person narrator. So in terms of writing about a character who you want to cook his goose a little bit, from the point of view of a first-person, right, what are the challenges of doing that?
Well, the challenges are just the challenges of finding the voice. And often you set out to do that and you find you can't do it. But it's a kind of ventriloquy. It's sort of exciting when you can suddenly find that you really can speak in a voice of someone who's not yourself. And if that works, it's sort of self-fueling, and it can get. It's a very restrictive form of writing. I mean, you can't step out of it. There's no perspective around what you're doing. It's just you're stuck in the middle of this thing. And it seems to me it would be very hard to write a great length in the first person for that very reason.
Right, and you have written two of your novels are first-person novels. So in terms of developing the first person into the long form, or using the first person as that long-form voice, given those difficulties, what kind of adjustments did you have to make?
Let me think about that. I think the hardest thing was to not be able to do any kind of observational scene setting outside of that voice, and it got to seem kind of claustrophobic after a while, and I would be very rude. You know, the thing that so many writers did, particularly Hemingway, was to use a third person, was almost a first-person voice.
Right.
And that's a very tempting thing to do, because you can alter the range of focus as you need it. The first person, you're locked in, you can't get out of there. And so you have to understand you're going to give up a lot of your tools as a writer once you set out to do that. On the other hand, if you can do it, it's kind of self-propelled in a way. It'll kind of fuel itself as you're writing. You begin to look at the world the way that person would look at the world. I know all of you spend a lot of time making faces in the mirror. And that's what first-person writing is like.
So, this is your third collection of short stories.
Right.
10 novels. I'm curious. I want to talk about the stories first, and then I want to talk a bit about the career. But I'm curious about the difference for you in terms of, what makes a short story and what makes a novel. Are they similar impulses to start out with? Have you ever had the experience where you didn't know, you thought you were writing a short story and it turned into a novel, or vice versa?
I've always wanted that to happen. I mean, Hemingway used to say that a novel was a short story that just wouldn't stop.
That's what they say about big earthquakes, too. They're little earthquakes that just drop.
That's a great analogy. I don't find that to be the case. In fact, I sometimes feel that I had to write a lot of novels to know enough about writing to be able to write short stories, because you really have to be kind of on top of it as a short story writer. You have to... And we were talking about this earlier, that Randall Jarrell had this famous definition of the novel, which is that it's a document of a certain length with something wrong with it. The other analogy would be writing plays. If any of you have tried to do that or been to them, a play with 5 or 10 dead minutes in it is a completely dead play. And I have heard myself telling this before, but short stories are a little bit like that. They're very intolerant of dead air. Novels can absorb any amount of it. In fact, that's the genius of the novel, in a way, seriously, it's so forgiving, and it's just a big baggy thing, that's short story writing is a much more disciplinary kind of thing. And any writers who've really done it well end up kind of thinking about how they do it a lot. Frank O'Connor famously is trying to understand how it is you actually write a short story. And, of course, we're all the children of Chekhov, who's inimitable, but points to the idea that in a short story, every perception should lead to another perception. There shouldn't really be any interstitial material other than the perceptions that move the story forward. Well, that's kind of a tough mistress right there. And when you write short stories, you understand there's that pressure to make something happen with every line. That's not the same as writing novels.
Did you write short stories? I know very early in your career, at the beginning of your career, you really aspired to be a certain kind of novelist, a comic novelist.
Right.
Sort of there was an ambition for novel writing. Did you write short stories early as part of your either as part of your apprenticeship or as part of your early experience of writing, or was that a form that you came to? The first collection didn't come out until the 1980s. Did you come to it later?
I did come to it later. Of course, like any other writer, I started writing short stories, and I even found some of them around the house, and thank God they never saw the light of day. But I think for any writer beginning, it's just nice to finish anything. You were talking about this, just to get to the end of something, to blacken enough pages to the point where you say, well, it's not any good, but it's finished.
Right. Nicholson Baker once said that the most important thing is to finish, because then at least you can fix it. If it's not finished, there's nothing there to fix.
And no, that I hadn't heard that, but that's exactly the case. And in fact, I think, over the long haul, I would have to say that writing is really more about revision than anything else. And Hemingway once said that nobody'd ever read anything he'd written. They'd only read what he had rewritten. And I love to get a first draft out of the way so that I really have some place to go and some place to get to work. And the advantage of liking revision is that it liberates you to take risks, because you know what you're doing is not final. If you're making a movie, you would want the ultimate cut ratio. If you'd want if 2-to-1 would be impossibly strict, if 5-to-1 would be great, if 12-to-1 would be great. And why shouldn't a writer give themselves that kind of liberty in drafting? So you'd say, well, this could work, this might not work, let's just write it and find out. At the end, you have this thing that's, some of it works, some of it doesn't work, some of it's underdeveloped, some of it could go elsewhere, some of it leads to another book, you throw this one out and start that one. But you really, until you've got a draft in hand, you have nothing to work with. You don't really have much to begin with. So revision is the secret of the game, I think, and most people have come to that.
Do you revise a short story the same way or with the same rigor? I know that some of your novels, I think I read that in 92 in the Shade you wrote 6 or 7 full drafts of before. Would you take a short story through that many or through even more drafts?
Right. And then I'm happy to have somebody look on and tell me what they think is going on. My wife is an avid reader, but she's not a literary person, certainly not an intellectual. But she has a great seat of the pants about what's working. Henry James said writing only has one obligation, and that is to be interesting. And if you follow that rule, you have great formal freedom. I mean, a lot of Chekhov stories can't be described in terms of their formal reality. It's just they're interesting.
Right.
They're
right.
Really interesting. And honestly, that's enough. What was your question?
Your Chekhov line gives me another question, which is, I think that applies to a lot of the stories in this book, because there are moments where, how would I put it? They seem incidental until they're not. Things happen, something happens, then it triggers something else happening.
Right.
You have, for instance, in the story where the protagonist is having the picnic with his blind grandmother, and then he notices a body drifting down the river. So he gets interested in that, and he leaves his grandmother by the side of the river. And, you know, so it's sort of the kind of the intercession of the sort of random or something that then sort of pushes the story in a whole other direction.
I am addicted to that. There's no question about it.
No, it's one of, but I'm curious about, so in terms of how much do you know when you sit down to write a story?
Well, not much.
How much do you know when you end a story?
Even less. You know, John Cheever once said something that really sort of lived by. He said most writers will kind of admit to this, that writing is pretty improvisatory at one level. In fact, when it's not, that's usually when there's not a lot of life in it. Mm-hmm. It's useful sometimes to imagine that you know where you're going, but you're kind of like a jazz musician in the sense you're just trying to see where the moments lead you. And again, combining that with the willingness to look at it again at the end and see where it happened. But if you don't have the daring to follow your instincts, nobody's smart enough to actually figure out how to write a good story or a good novel. It can't be, maybe Henry James could, I don't know, but it mostly can't be imagined from overhead. You just have to get in there. Scott Fitzgerald said writing fiction, he said, is like holding your breath underwater. And that rings a bell for me. I mean, it's just you're trying to get into that tantric state, you know, where you start to see things, and then you come back out of it, and you don't know where you are. You can't remember what you said. Another Chekhov story that really, really resonated for me. He was out at his little dacha, a little summer place, with a lot of friends, and he was writing a story. And he was almost done with the story, and this violent little summer thunderstorm came up. All the windows and doors were open, and it blew his story out into the yard and rained all over it. And his friend said, well, you just finished it, you know, just while it's fresh in your mind, just go back in and write it down again. And Chekhov said, I have to be honest with you. He said, I can't remember anything about it. That's a really true writer's story.
Now, you do also, in some of these stories, you do what I would call telegraph. You telegraph the endings, right. Or you telegraph things that are going to happen. I'm just going to find it here. There's a moment in Lake's story where you say, just this simple sentence, that's when I had the idea that ruined everything.
Right.
And then the story goes sort of over the cliff from there. You know, in some ways, that's sort of it's sort of an anti-suspense moment. You're almost sort of giving, and there are other moments where you sort of say, you know, this is what happened to these characters. They didn't know they weren't going to see them again, and then we see what happened to them. I'm curious about that as a kind of storytelling strategy or storytelling device.
Well, it's a little bit of a sort of playful thing with the reader, which is, this is what I did that ruined everything, and then let the reader guess what that might be, and then cruelly fool the reader.
Well, it's interesting because in that story in particular, without giving too much away to the reader or to the readers, this happens as they're about to get into a boat. So you can imagine all sorts of potential ruinous outcomes.
Right.
It turns out that the actual ruinous outcome is, at least to me, was completely unpredictable.
Right.
So there is that sense of I mean, we often talk about kind of the relationship between writers and readers, or the conversation between writers and readers. And so I'm curious about this in that context.
You know, Barry Lopez said this thing that really stuck in my mind. He was talking about something completely different. He was talking about the relationship of wolves and their prey, wildlife that they preyed on. And he said they've been doing this for so many, they've evolved together. And so the wolves that are trying to kill caribou and the caribou that are trying to avoid being killed by wolves are having this very complex conversation. And I think that's very much a relationship between performers of any kind and their audiences, or writers and their readers. There is this conversation going on. And the motives are very different from either end, but the conversation is highly evolved. That's what I think, you know, literature should really raise that idea to a very high level. And it assumes very inventive and accomplished artists and very alert consumers, or whatever they are in this case, readers, So I always kind of have that in mind that I am writing this story that's going kind of along like this, but I'm really having a conversation with this imaginary entity out there or people who might read this thing.
When you say the motivations are very different, I mean, obviously we know what the motivations are, or we can assume what the motivations of the wolves and the caribou are, but I want to go a little further. What do you see as the motivation of the writer and also the motivation of the reader? Or even if we speak personally, for you as a writer and also as a reader, what's the difference between your motivation as a writer and your motivation as a reader?
Well, I wonder if I can answer that. I honestly think, if you were to read a writer like Artaud, you really have the feeling that it gives him pleasure to treat the reader with disdain and cruelty.
And that's when he's being nice.
That's on a good day. Then on the opposite end of it would be James Patterson or somebody who just wants to make that reader happy.
Right.
Forget his or her troubles and just have a good time for 921 pages. It depends. It's different in every case. Mm-hmm. I think that the sort of the trickster idea has always been kind of appealed to me, which is this sort of mesmerizing the reader in a way, and then offering some often comic challenges, but playing with the expectations that the reader might have. Chekhov does that a lot, but he there's never an element of cruelty. In fact, Chekhov's goal was to eliminate cruelty in the world, but it didn't hamper his ingenuity as a storyteller. So that's a little bit, on a good day, I'd like to rise to.
Has that changed for you over the course of your career? I mean, I think, looking back to sort of the early novels, The Sporting Club, Bushwhacked
right.
Piano, 92 in the Shade, was your motivation or your sensibility different? How has your approach to the work and to the conversation changed?
I think that as a young male, I was just trying to be cool. No, I think I was trying to set some sort of stylized life example, and these kind of characters I picked, these situations I picked. And I think that's something that can be very interesting, can work really well for a while. Mm-hmm. And I hate to keep thinking of him, but you can see how it expires in a writing life like Hemingway's, where it starts out, in a book like Farewell to Arms or something, as being an electrifying kind of situation of males in peril, and then you just have drunken bums by the end of the career, having cocktails on a yacht. I mean, he really needed to change gears at some point, and he never did.
Yeah, he falls off the table fairly quickly, I think, certainly as a novelist, maybe not so much as a short story.
No, I think he did too. I think he was done in his mid-30s.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I would think too.
Islands in the Stream, that last book, is just unbelievably god-awful book. It's all about mixing drinks.
Right.
I mean, I have two pages of some fantastic cocktail he's daydreaming about, looking at his watch, wondering when 5 o'clock's going to roll around and quit this writing stuff.
Right. So, in terms of that, that early motivation or that early sensibility, that idea of sort of writing the novel as grand statement, let's say, or the
right.
novel. At what point does that? How does that change for you over the course of a? We're talking about a career that's 45 plus years. How does that change over the course of that career, and how does it change you as a writer?
Well, I think it's everybody's story in a way, which is that you spend a certain portion of your life trying to figure out who you are, mm-hmm. And you send out these test flags, to see how you're in the form of stories and novels. A lot of them are really trying to define your own space as a person, much less as a writer. And then at some point in your career, you kind of get a general idea of who you are. I remember when we were talking earlier, I worked with Robert Altman one time when he was about 63, he said, just in the last few months, I finally figured out who I am. But that's what we are striving to do, and we get more and more convinced about who we are as we go in. And if you're a writer, it starts to change your style, and you start talking about things other than yourself, or the goal of it is not to define your times or your space. It's really to tell stories about other people. And you wish you could have, in a way, gotten to that earlier. But it's kind of the challenge of a long career, I think. You know, it's in defiance of the famous statement, there are no second acts in American literature.
Said by a man who died at 44.
Yeah. Just was making a point.
Well, for him, there was no real second act, right?
Right.
But anyway, you were saying, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, you just go on. Hopefully I've got the gist of who I am now. I'm not solid with it yet. But I know I'm too old to have a midlife crisis, so I'd like to kind of bring this to a conclusion.
I'm curious, too. I mean, I would be remiss, certainly, without asking you about the period in which you were writing screenplays. You actually directed the adaptation of 92 in the Shade. And I was thinking about this when you're talking about sort of the shooting ratio, because as I recall, you actually shot two endings to that,
right,
to that movie, both the sort of the ending that mirrored the book, and then an ending that was
right,
sort of more upbeat or happier. I'm curious about that experience a little bit and how that either dovetails or really differs from the act of writing prose.
Well, in the case of directing 92 in the Shade, we shot the ending in the first 2 days of the shoot.
Right.
So, you know, you're trying to keep all your options open, and you know that you can't simply replicate the book. You know, I mean, a movie's always going to... I remember one instance about that. Harry Cruise had written a great book, and Sean Penn bought the rights to it. And he was explaining to Harry Cruise, he said, you know, this is a movie, and it's going to have to change a lot. It's going to, you know, it's not going to be exactly what you wrote. And Harry Cruise said, don't worry about it, Sean. My book's in the library.
Right. It reminds me of, this is one of my favorite sort of writer in Hollywood stories is, that, you know, there's an anecdote where Norman Mailer said the best way for a writer to interact with Hollywood is to drive up to the border of California, throw your novel over the border, let them throw the money back over the border, and then
right,
drive away.
Yeah. Wow.
But then he also directed, you know, a couple of his...
Oh, that was dreadful. Yeah. But I remember when Faulkner left Hollywood, they were cleaning out his desk, and there were two or three empty bourbon bottles on the desk, and there were a couple of legal pads where he had written over 500 times, boy meets girl, boy meets girl. Just trying to get in the mood.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I really notice most and admire most about your fiction is that a lot of it involves people who work. I mean, or describes work, or work is a big part of it. And I feel, it seems to me that work has sort of fallen out of the fictional purview. But your characters work. They have jobs. We watch them work. This goes back to the beginning. I mean, it goes back to 92 in the Shade and sort of certainly to the characters in this book. There's a quality of doing things.
Right.
I wanted to ask you about that.
Well, that's just one of my interests. I mean, I like to see people. I don't care what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife is driven crazy by this trait of mine, because we'll stop at a gas station and I'll always end up in the back bay watching people change tires and things like that. But that's kind of how we are on the planet. I mean, we all have to do stuff. And I think there's a danger of kind of, as we're sort of liberated from the need to do things. As Buckminster Fuller said, the world's eventually going to be divided between those who produce and those who are only asked to consume. And he added that the vast majority of humanity will only be required to consume. That makes me think those will be the least interesting humans on the planet, and they're not the ones I would want to write about. But we're defined by work. I mean, I've had to raise a bunch of children, and I've assured them that that's the only way they're ever going to really be happy, is working. And it doesn't matter to me what it is, but it has to be work. So that's a kind of the key human activity that sort of holds my attention enough to want to write anything about it.
Right. At the end of Weight Watchers, which is the first story in the collection, you write, or the narrator says, I like to be tired. In some ways, that's the point of what I do. I don't want to be thinking when I go to bed, or if there is some residue from the day, I want it to drain out and precipitate me into nothingness. I've always enjoyed the idea of non-existence. I view pets with extraordinary suspicion. We need to stay out of their lives. I saw a woman fish a little dog out of her purse once, and it bothered me for a year. It's not that there's anything wrong with my ability to communicate. I have a cell phone, but I only use it to call out. But I wonder about that quality of liking to be tired, and that sort of that sense of, in some ways, that is one of the things that work provides us.
Right, it does. I mean, in this case, I mean, this protagonist is somebody badly damaged by his family, and so his inability to connect to other people and his hiding behind his one-way cell phone and things like that really are indications of the damage. But you know, the downside of where my ex-son-in-law is a novelist, Walter Kern, and I saw him the other day, and I said, "Are you writing a novel?" And he said, "Thank God, no." And I understood what he meant, because, I mean, when it goes well, it's very absorbing work. And time just goes by. And, I mean, the portions of your life disappear, and you get completely caught up, and you don't care about anything else. And you miss a lot during work. And so, I mean, it's a matter of titrating work with other valuable things in your life. I talked to David McCullough about this one time. He's a great biographer, and he'd written the biography of Harry Truman. And he said he was very, very fond of his father-in-law. And he disappeared into this book for years. When he finally finished it, he asked his wife about his father-in-law. And his wife said, "Oh, he died a couple of years ago." Saul Bellow talks about being really caught up with soaring with the piece of fiction that he was writing. And when he got to a point where he could stop or look back at what he's done, he realized with genuine astonishment that his wife had left him. And those are kind of true stories. And it's why anybody who has had this experience, done this kind of work, is sort of wary of it a little bit, because you get in there and you can't get back out just because you thought you'd like to. So that's work. That's the downside of work.
Right.
And it's a serious downside. It's life-consuming, and it's dehumanizing, all the bad things.
And, I mean, you've talked about writing in this way. I mean, at one point you talked about sort of being a writer who sits down for long periods of time, not, you know, someone not working for an hour and a half a day, right. But really sort of approaching it as right. work, sitting down at the desk no matter what, day in, day out, not missing a day of work,
right.
even at moments of, you know, of despair or dissolution or whatever. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that in terms of your process of writing, that sense
of... First of all, I'll tell you, that's what I used to do. I've actually kind of revised my view of that, because I don't think you can really write all day long. I used to think you could, and I was my fear of failure or my need to make a living, various other things, had me really staying in there much longer than I needed to.
Was it detrimental to the writing, do you think?
I don't think so. I just think that nothing happened. It was detrimental to life, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't do it that way again. I mean, I would understand that, you know, as the rodeo people say, there's a time to try, there's a time to fly, and a smart bird knows why, i.e. you're getting bucked off. And I think a reasonable idea about writing is to write, you know, a certain reasonable amount of time, and to understand when nothing else is coming and not try to empty the tank every day. I spent lots of time just sitting there doing absolutely nothing except my life going by. I might have had a good morning, but I was still there at 5, and it had been 4 hours since anything significant happened. Right. And that was an unhealthy approach to writing, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That was a direct response to fear of failure.
So your approach now is, do you write every day? Do you still write every day?
I do once I really get going on something. You know, when I start a project, I work very little. I mean, because I really don't have an idea what I'm doing, and it gradually builds, and then I'm just working day and night on it, right. If it's a novel. One of the things I like about short stories is there is a foreseeable exit from the project.
Right. Well, and you know, I think Richard Ford once said, the advantage of being a writer is when you're working on something, you can work on something. You know, you work all the time, or you can work all the time. But when you're done, you don't. You know, you can take 6 months and not work on anything or do something else.
Right.
I'm curious also about sort of those other aspects of your life, the ranching, the horse work, and how those either. I guess how those connect to writing or don't connect to writing in terms of, I guess, how all those pieces fit together into the totality of a life.
I'd like to think they certainly don't fit together, probably. They're just things that I have had a lot of enthusiasm about, and I didn't think they were hurting anything. I raised cattle for 40 years or something like that. But when I look back on it, I remember days at the sale yard and shipping calves and gathering cattle, horseback, and odd times of the day and night, and all those things are amazing. They really have given me a sense of a life of richness while all that was going on. I don't regret it. I certainly didn't make much money at it, but it was just a way of being engaged in the world, I really like the world. It didn't have to be that. It could have been. I could have had a bookstore. Or I could have had a hot rod shop. I love hot rods. I would love to have built hot rods. A lot of things, but just anything that kind of gets you out there, gives you some partners in what you're doing, things to talk about, people to review life with. And writing, the terrible thing about writing is that it's an isolating experience, and if you don't find ways to offset that, you're kind of. It's like the end of Little Black Sambo, where all the tigers turn into butter. I mean, you just disappear in your own atmosphere.
I'm curious about the question of place. You were raised, you were born in Massachusetts, right? And then moved to...
Actually born in Michigan, but my family Michigan, are all from Massachusetts.
And then lived in Michigan, and then traveled and ended up in Montana in the early late 60s. So how has place been a factor in your writing? I mean, it clearly Montana is a significant factor in terms of the content of the writing. Do you consider yourself a writer of place?
Not really.
Okay.
Probably not. I mean, I love Montana, and I love the almost half century of time that I've had there. But I've never wanted to be a local color writer, and I've never wanted to be a regionalist. Mm-hmm. It's just the cards that I've been dealt. I never decided to live there. I was there running out of money when my first book was sold. I had an infant child, and the neighbors were nice, and I thought, well, I'll stay for another month or two and figure out what to do with my life, and there went my life.
Right.
But it's been, that's fine. I mean, one of the things I love about Montana is your children never move away.
Right.
And that's been great. And it's an interesting place. It's not like the neighboring states. It's a much more diverse place because of its history of railroading and mining, and there are too many colleges in the state. I mean, we have the University of Montana produces more Rhodes Scholars per capita than any other college in the nation. It's just it's just kind of an interesting place. And for writers, it works pretty well because you don't really stick out there. They've seen plenty of screwballs.
And there's a strong writer. I mean, there are a lot of writers, right? There's Jim Harrison was there. Bill Kittredge.
Right.
Yeah. But in some ways, I mean, have you found... I mean, it seems to me, reading your work, that as you've progressed through your career, the work has become more spare in some way. The prose has become more spare. The storytelling has become more spare. And I guess I wonder, is that Richard Ford, when he was writing the Montana stories, said that there was something about the landscape of Montana that made him sort of strip down his language.
Right.
Do you think that, in your case, do you think that that has to do with sort of the fact that the presence of Montana, or the fact that the stories are set in Montana, or do you think it's more a matter of your own kind of development and maturation as a writer?
I think a little bit of it is the kind of people I live among. Mm-hmm. I realize, whether I wanted to or not, that I was reluctant to write things that my neighbors and friends and relatives and stuff couldn't possibly read. And the other thing is, we've had ranch hands and cowboys work on the place for years and years, and I always give them books. And I'm not going to give them David Foster Wallace. You really begin to understand that. I mean, there's a kind of elitism about a lot of stuff that we love that, you know, nobody else can use. And there's nothing wrong with it. And I personally think David Foster Wallace is a wonderful writer. Mm-hmm. But you get impacted by the world that you live in. And my neighbors read all my stuff. I kind of want them to be able to get something out of it rather than just thinking that I've been drinking or...
So there is that question of accessibility then,
right?
Right. And I'm curious about that too, because accessibility often is, you know, gets a bad rap. It's often a dirty word. In creative culture.
Well, I always think of it this way: one man's accessible is another man's obvious. And so, you know, that's a tricky line to follow.
Right.
At some level or another, it has to be sort of accessible. Otherwise, what use is it, you know?
Well, it comes back to the question of the conversation, right?
Right.
If it's not accessible, then it can't really be a conversation.
It's oratory, right?
It's a monologue.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think there's no... You can't share. Does that tie into... In terms of the short stories, does that have an effect on the issue of length? Some of the short stories are quite long. Some of the short stories are quite short. The story you read is about 5 or 6 pages.
Right.
Some of the stories in the book are, you know, up to 30-plus pages.
Right.
I'm curious about that as a kind of a mechanism, a storytelling mechanism.
Well, I think what it is, when you set out to write something and you have a kind of a, you know, John O'Hara had this thing. He said, I put two people together and get them talking. And then he said, so I go someplace, I never know where. Mm-hmm. I have a different feeling when I'm writing, which is I feel a kind of pulse in the story. And it's like a heartbeat or something. And if it continues to pulse forward, I'll follow it wherever it's going. And I'm often completely surprised at where things are going. And sometimes they just don't run their course in a short period of time. Mm-hmm. But you can always tell when they're kind of out of gas, I mean, or you've gone too long. That's another thing that you often find in revision. We used to have a rule training horses, and we trained lots of them. One of the rules was never ask a horse to do something he was going to do anyway. And I try to apply that to writing a little bit. I mean, if you're writing something and the reader could write the next sentence for himself, well, then don't write that sentence.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, that's the Hemingway model, right? If it's obvious to the reader,
right,
leave it out because
right,
you don't need to put it in.
Right.
It's interesting. I mean, let's talk for a second. You dedicate this book to Barry Hanna, who I think I revere as a short story writer.
Do.
And I'm curious about, I'd love to talk a little bit about him, but also get a sense of the kind of writers, whether you're contemporaries or other writers, who you look to as kind of peers or role models.
Well, there are lots of them, and a lot of them are kind of children of Barry Hanna in a way, because he was such an inventive, daredevil writer, and he was also kind of nearly half crazy. One of the early things I remember about Barry, he was a writer in residence at University of Montana. And he had this fantasy life that he was a jet pilot.
Remember he wrote those? About it. I mean, there's some great jet pilot short stories.
I know, and almost everybody had figured it out, but I hadn't figured it out. And I thought he was a jet pilot. And he called up one day and he said, are you going to be home on the ranch? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, I've got to ferry a Grumman dive bomber from Alaska to Texas, and I'm going to fly right over the ranch. So be on the lookout. Well, my wife and I, as a sort of pair of goobers, every time an airplane went over, it's Barry. he was kind of all in his head. And then he would do things that were so arbitrary. You know, he loved animals, and so they made him the president of the Oxford, Mississippi Humane Society. And they were going to give a little party for him when he was elevated. So he arrived absolutely blind drunk, with a friend of his who was a heroin addict. He was staggering around and walked in and said, why you people care so much about animals is absolutely beyond me. So he had to start with a fairly loose grip on reality.
But But that's part of the beauty of those stories, is they kind of unravel in these miraculous ways, completely unexpected ways, you know. If you guys haven't read Barry Hanna, some of these stories are they're the weirdest and most beautiful things I've ever seen.
Airships, a collection of his stories that I would really recommend if you were curious about him. And a short novel called Ray. I think they were really exemplary work, brand new. You've never seen anything like this.
Right. What other writers would you count among, among you, either influences or peers, writers that you sort of have looked to throughout your career?
Throughout my career. I used to say that I was raised on Jews and Southern women. And I think, I know that Augie March, Saul Bellow's Augie March, was a book that for me and a lot of people about my age was a sort of liberating text, much as Huckleberry Finn was for a previous generation. But then there were all these Flannery O'Connor and I'm trying to think of them. Anyway, lots of Southern women writers of that day, mostly short story writers. Carson McCullers. I'm coming up short with all the names, but those were really key writers to us. The early Hemingway short stories were very important to us. I was a great fan of Turgenev because of his love of, you know, the land and this kind of potent sort of melancholy that he had about things. And then I always liked writers who were what I would call serious writers but had a comic undercurrent. Not necessarily all that well known, but there was a writer named Italo Svevo who wrote a book called Confessions of Zeno, which was an extreme model to me. A Brazilian writer named Machado de Assis, we were talking about this earlier, Epitaph of a Small Winter. These were all, you know, marvelously serious books, but they're all quite funny, and that appealed to me. Gogol was an early hero of mine, Dead Souls, the so-called phenomenon of laughter through tears, I thought was always a great thing to aspire to. And so those were kind of out there as people I looked
up. It's interesting to hear you mention O'Connor, because I think of a story like Good Man is Hard to Find, which has that same kind of almost serendipitous turn, you know, the sort of the intrusion of the unexpected that then kicks the story into a whole other territory that we didn't know was there.
I just learned about her that she sometimes spent 6 or 8 months on a story.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're, you know, they're exemplary stories. I mean, they'll be around forever. And then there are a lot of good. Did I just do that?
Yeah.
There are a lot of wonderful young short story writers around now. We were talking about earlier David Means, Donald Antrim, Miley Malloy, Rivka Galchen. Anyway, they're numerous at this point in time, and they're really all terribly good. You can read them in The New Yorker or McSweeney's or Granta or lots of other places, but it's a renaissance of good young short story writers right now.
Do you intend to keep writing stories? Do you think you're going to write another novel? Where do you see yourself moving at this point?
I feel that I ought to write a novel, but I really want to write some more short stories. I know I'm going to see Toby Wolf soon. He's a great short story writer, but he feels he's now, you know, he's kind of retired. He's supposed to write a huge novel. You know, we all sort of go down that route, and I'm not sure it's a good idea.
Right. So he is not writing he is writing the huge novel.
I think he's writing a huge novel.
Yeah.
He'll undoubtedly bring it off. He's a marvelous writer.
Right. No, I wonder. I mean, I it's an interesting question because I feel like we live in such a moment of kind of distracted attention span that it seems like a moment really suited for.
I think that's
stories.
Right. I saw a quote of V.S. Naipaul's that really stuck to my current mood. He said, "When I hear the word novel, I want to puke."
Well, that's going back to what Walter was saying, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I read a lot of novels. It does require that kind of that kind of commitment. But there is something about the there always has been, but there's something about the short story and its ability to sort of capture a moment. In a moment, we read it, you know, the value of reading something in one sitting.
Right. And also, it's a kind of characteristically American art form. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look back in writers like Stephen Crane and
Sherwood Anderson.
Sherwood Anderson, the fabulous Sherwood Anderson. Yeah. I mean, that's very American kind of writing. I mean, you know, for example, I have, like lots of writers in my situation, I have European publishers, and my French publisher is kind of frustrated because my last two collections of short stories have done well, and she just can't, you know, the French are just not interested in them. It's not anything, they're attuned to. It's not one of their things.
Right. I think we should open it up to questions from the audience. Do you guys, there's some microphones. We have two, right? There are two microphones. So raise your hand and wait for the microphone so that everybody can hear your questions. And over there, yeah.
Tom, I was wondering if you could say something about Richard Brautigan and whether or not you think he'll be remembered more for his poetry or his prose.
Well, you know, I think his prose probably, and I think most of it's going to rest on trout fishing in America, which I, you know, really is still one of the most requested books in American libraries. It's like in the top 10 after all these years. And it's a magical book. It's a great book. I saw Billy Collins recently, the poet laureate, and he did an introduction to a special edition of Trout Fishing in America. And it's much more universal than we thought it was when we thought it was just some hippie extravaganza. That's the one that holds me the most over the long haul. I can't speak for posterity, but I think that's a lasting one. I don't know who asked that question. Who is it?
Gentleman over
there. Somebody over there?
Yeah. We have one over here.
Oh. Hi, Tom. My mom is Lee Oprea. And
Hi. You're Leah.
How are you?
I saw your sister yesterday in Denver.
I know. It's all over Facebook.
Yeah.
I have to interrupt. I'd like to ask...
Leah's mother was my girlfriend when I was 10 years old. We've never been out of touch in all the 60 years, I guess. Something like that, you know.
Well, that kind of leads into this question is, when did you first start telling stories?
I first started telling stories? That you're just teeing me up for this little tale, aren't you? Well, Leah's mother had, her parents had bought a refrigerator, or I think it was a refrigerator, and the packing crate was out in the yard. And I was, I guess, 11 years old, maybe. And I used to go over and get in the packing crate. And your mother would climb out of her bedroom window and come down on the packing crate on the condition that I tell her stories. So that was kind of the beginning of my career, such as it's been. You know, did you know that story already? Did she tell you?
Oh,
yeah. Oh, she asked you to tell? Oh, yeah, yeah. Leah's mother is a control freak.
So it really was a setup. What other?
I might be imagining things, but in this To Skin a Cat collection, it seemed like you did a lot of, I guess it's foreshadowing, like you told what was going to happen in the end of the story, in the beginning of the story, and then it all unfolded. Did I imagine this, or was this intentional?
You know, I wish I had a better memory of it, because the book is, I haven't seen that book in 25 years. But
I can
imagine doing that, though. I mean, I still do some of that. I might do it with a lighter hand, but I've always been sort of interested in that technique where somebody tells you exactly what's going to happen, and the challenge is to find a kind of a crooked but logical trail to how it happened. So I must have done it on purpose. So I think it's funny when I have looked back at that book, there's some of the stories I really don't like anymore, and one of them is the title story.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I just thought that was a little bit too dire.
It was pretty dire.
Yeah.
But it was funny to me.
That actually raises a question for me. Do you have books of yours that are particular favorites or books of yours that are, let's say, not favorites? Do you care to say?
Yes, in both cases. I mean, I was always kind of fond of Panama because it got kind of beat up by the critics when it came out. And then since then, they're...
I was going to ask you about that, but then as a critic, I thought I would back away from the...
Right. I mean, it was... I remember Richard Brautigan said to me when it came out, I had been really babied by the critics in my previous book. Then Brautigan said, they're going to kill you on the next one. And they did. But since that time, a lot of people have decided that they like that better than any of my other books. I was sort of so defensive about it for a while because I didn't understand the treatment that it had gotten at the time, and it's done fine since then, that I thought that was my favorite. But it's sort of like having a child with challenges of some kind. You kind of load your affection on it for that very reason. Right. I'm just really kind of high on these short story books that I've done, these last things. I'm really liking them. 92 in the Shade, I did something I could never have done again. I had such a complete commitment to that book when I was writing that I could recite the book at the end when I had done the last. I could recite the whole book. So I knew it very well. So it represents period in my life where I did exactly what I meant to do, right, wrong, or indifferent. So that's kind of still kind of a favorite in a way.
Okay. Yeah, question up there.
Hello. I have a question about, I have a lot of friends who are newer writers, younger writers, and it seems like they've jumped on the trend of writing memoirs, multiple memoirs. Yeah. And I know that it's been thrown around that a memoir is somebody who writes one is a lazy writer. But I've read several of them, and there's some that are written really poorly and some that are written really well. And so I was just curious, since you might be considered old school, if I can say that generously, what your thought is of the memoir as a form of writing?
Well, it's the same standard that applies to any book. Is it a good one? Harry Cruz's Childhood, I think, is just a great book. It's a memoir. There's a book by Dorothy Allison called Bastard Out of Carolina, which is a great book. And there have been lots of great memoirs. And then the poor guy got so in trouble for faking his memoir. I thought, what's the problem? I mean, everybody liked the book. So those are the standards. I think, though, that there's been something in the air to encourage people to think that their story is just enthralling and might as well do a contract. So I'm not a big memoir reader, but the ones I have read, there have been two or three of them that were outstanding books. Yes.
I like Panama. But I wanted to ask you about the title story in Crow Fair, and kind of, I thought in your last novel and in this short story collection, there's sort of more of an attention to issues of sort of American Indians as they pertain to Montana life, and I wondered if there's something that had sort of brought you to that subject in the last couple of books.
You mean the, I wonder if I understand your question. Say that in another way, just...
Just insofar as Crow Fair seems to, that the story seems to speak to the sort of relation of sort of white life in Montana to the Native American antecedent.
Like, right. Yeah. Well, Native American life is very close to us. Anywhere you live in Montana, there's 7 reservations there. I have a friend who's actually my FedEx delivery guy who I fish with, and he's a Crow Indian. And he's the great-grandson of Custer's chief of scouts, who was killed in the Battle of Little Bighorn. And they think he found his great-grandfather's skeleton when the river changed course last year. They found a skeleton. They think it was Mitch Boyer, who was a mixed-blood Santee, who was a Custer's trusted scout, and a great frontiersman himself. So, that's, the Indian life's not too far away from us. It's sort of de-exotified in a way. I mean, we just, you know Indians. That's all there is to it. And it's kind of part of your life. And so some of the political apparatus that overlays discussions or conversations about American Indians, we don't quite have that because, my son's roommate was a Assiniboine Indian in college. And it's just not, it's a different issue for us, let's say, and you can't not talk about it if you talk about life in Montana.
Okay.
You say at the beginning, starting out your stories, there isn't that much to do because you don't know them yet. My question would be about how you come to your ideas or your ideas come to you. Do they come in the time that you give yourself away from writing, or do you ever find yourself thinking, what should I write about now? And then they come to you as part of that process. And when do you know you have an idea that it's clear enough in your mind that you want to start to write about it?
There's a rancher saying that I think applies to writing, which is, you can't plow a field by turning it over in your mind. And there's a huge part of, it's like Woody Allen said, 99% of life is showing up. And that's really true of writing. I mean, and I have never really learned this well enough. I think, what am I going to write? I make notes, I do all this stuff. I read more, and I study more, and I cook up little schemes, and nothing really happens until you sit down and actually start writing. And then it's amazing the luminosity that comes into things. And it is rooted in a lot of the things you've been daydreaming about or writing down or other books you're reading. But really nothing much happens until you actually start blackening pages. But that comes out of the preoccupations you've had. But you really can't. My experience is that you really can't plan a book of fiction beyond a certain very minimal point without actually trying to write it.
Hi, I'm actually interested in your distinction between not being a regionalist writer, and who do you consider a regionalist writer, and why don't you consider yourself a regionalist? What's wrong with being a regionalist?
Okay. What's wrong with, there's nothing wrong with being it, but I think that, we have a certain pressure to be regionalist writers living in places like Montana or Wyoming. We have, we have a sort of a chamber of commerce driven idea of what real writing would be about. I mean, Montana, only 2 or 3% of Montanans are ranchers. But I think the feeling among the sort of canon builders in the state is that that's really the proper topic for writing or life about settlers or homesteaders or something like that. I would say, nobody tried to make Updike write about whaling. Why should I write about these things? But I think there's a certain kind of local color writing, and there's nothing wrong with writing that takes a deep account of the place that it's set in or the peculiarities of the local people and so on. There's nothing wrong with that at all. My beef with it is that the Montana or the Western life that I see day to day is not at all like what's been in the official literature. Much of what you would experience in Montana is what you would experience anywhere. People going to PTA meetings, people fixing their cars, secretaries, pizza makers. And for some reason, for a long time in my part of the world, that was considered to be beneath the attention of serious writers. So that's really all I mean by that.
I think we are out of time. Thank you, Tom Gwain.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.